Hi, I'm Liam O'Rourke, and this week I get to relive fun Survivor Series memories, such as Warlord backdropping Shawn Michaels out of the TV screen in 90, Yokozuna giving Virgil a shellacking in 92, and Bret Hart spitting in Vince's face in 97. God, even the Hitman's loogies were excellently executed.
I'm Carl Jones. To my friends, I'm known as Shawn Michaels Blue Knight. To my family, I'm known as the Gobbledygooker. And to complete strangers, I'm Conquistador number 2.
I'm G. John Chase. What the fuck is Alberto Del Rio doing back in WWE? For Christ's sake, I had to wait years to get rid of this fucker, and now he's come back after a 1 year absence? Looks like I'm gonna have to do this again. Give me Hogan's number.
And I'm Kieran O'Rourke. Never forget, folks, you can follow me on Twitter at WrestlingProfit, and for the next 100 people to follow me, you get a free illustrated edition of my thesis on what I believe Paige has had a boob job. That's at WrestlingProfit.
Get on it. This is the panel for the 59th Squared Circle Gazette Radio, and you can hear us talk about Survivor Series from 1987 to 1999 next. Welcome to the 59th Squared Circle Gazette Radio. I am Liam O'Rourke, alongside Carl Jones.
Believe it or not, folks, I'm not as old as the Survivor Series.
G. John Chase.
Unicorn Magic.
And back on the saddle, Kieran O'Rourke.
Booty!
And we are back this week for part one of what will be a two-part series looking at the history of the Survivor Series pay-per-view from inception to the current day. Very much looking forward to this show. A lot of different reasons I wanted to do this show, partly because obviously there's so many great memories of Survivor Series. We've got this year's edition coming up. The story of Survivor Series in itself, as this pay-per-view that's been kind of struggling for relevance and importance and identity almost ever since the beginning, to me, is kind of an interesting journey in itself. And when we sent this out to you guys, we asked for your fondest Survivor Series memories. So we're going to get a lot of positive vibes here after we talked about the most hated world title reigns ever last week. Thoughts about the Survivor Series at a kind of broad level. Fan of the pay-per-view concept itself around the table very quickly?
I will say, when you told me this was going to be the topic, I was really intrigued by this one, fascinated by it, because, like you say, it's a pay-per-view that's sort of almost fallen by the wayside over recent years. And I always found that quite strange, and in many ways quite sad, in the sense of, from a historical point of view, it's obviously the second oldest, which I think is something that a lot of fans will either forget about or possibly not even be aware of from a younger generation. And also, as a child, it was one that I really looked forward to because of the uniqueness of it, in the same way I looked forward to the Rumble. Just because they were different shows, there was a different vibe in the sense of the elimination competition, four against four or five against five, depending on the year. Yeah, I find it quite sad in a way what's become of the event, but obviously we'll get to that in greater detail as we go along.
Similarly, I was always a fan. I always liked the team concept of, you know, who's going to team with who and things like this. The emphasis of it is disappointing, but you know, there is a certain inevitability about it, the way the business has changed in terms of, you know, the TV structure and stuff. So, but we'll get more into that, no doubt.
I actually think it's very similar to King of the Ring. It was a show that had a great natural concept to it, which worked, you know, very early on in its creation, particularly in the 90s, but has since been either hideously undervalued or just completely misused by the powers that be at WWE. And so it's just now like a pale imitation. You know, King of the Ring's gone now, pretty much, but Survivor Series still lingers. I mean, if like the King of the Ring is like the dodo, and Survivor Series is like the pandas that won't fuck, you know, they won't breed, you know, they're just staying stagnant, just holding each other's dicks. But, you know, looking at this little fact sheet that Liam has given to us and looking at some of these results and some of these just shows full stop, it's fucking horrendous. And quite frankly, I'll be interested to see which one of us still survives at the end of this.
Oh, that's extremely harsh take, I feel. It's going to be interesting. Like I said, we're doing this in two parts. So for this part of the for this show, we're doing from 1987 through to 1999. And next week we'll be talking 2000 to 2014, as to see the kind of differences and the way that the pay-per-view's been treated over these two halves. We'll get straight away here. 1987, Survivor Series. And I don't know if you want to tell the story, or shall I, about why Survivor Series came to be in the first place, and talk about relevance and importance. It was absolutely crucial.
The significance of it can't be understated. Yeah, I mean, it's tantamount to a big fuck you from Vince McMahon to Jim Crockett Promotions as a way to completely screw with Starrcade. You know, I'm sure many of our listeners know the story, but for those that don't, it was Vince McMahon decided to hold Survivor Series and basically threatened other pay-per-view carriers that unless they showed a Survivor Series exclusively and not show Jim Crockett's Starrcade that was coming from Chicago that year, then they would withhold the rights for those carriers to then show WrestleMania the following year, which obviously coming off the back of WrestleMania 3 and the monster business that did, meant that Jim Crockett very much got the rug pulled from under him. And, well, I don't want to say less than, but within less than a full year, Jim Crockett's having to sell up to Ted Turner.
The actual inception of the show is pretty fascinating, of course, but a great classic Vince McMahon dick move, you know, when other people do it to him, it's a dirty trick. When he does it, it's just genius business. Strummer from Pro Wrestling Only says, I just remember the first one in 87. I was 8 years old and in awe that there was a pay-per-view other than WrestleMania. We had to go to my uncle's house to watch it, and a bunch of us watched it in a little cove he had upstairs of his house. What sticks out is the big tag team match and Bam Bam being able to hang with the monster heels in the main event. There was an older relative of my cousin watching with us who was rooting for all the heels and rubbing us the whole night about how awesome the Honky Tonk Man was and how Andre would crush Hogan. The U2001, also from Pro Wrestling Only, says, I remember renting the 87 and 88 versions of the show, and as a Hulkamaniac, I was super upset about Hogan's cheap elimination in the 87 main event. My family was moving into a new house that my dad was renovating, and my brother and I, as young kids, watched the first Survivor Series on VHS. We were both hooked on the new show. It was a fond memory of mine in my early wrestling fandom. Those shows are special to me, and I still watch them a few times a year. Wanted to get to those kind of comments first, because I think that touches on a lot of that sentiment about why people have fond memories about the Survivor Series. It kind of harkens back to that time. Obviously, we all got into it as kids, and this was a staple of WWF wrestling as a kid. Yeah, even if in reality this may not translate into the modern day, and we'll get to that next week, obviously, there's that feeling of it's a component missing. There wasn't too much on this show that held major consequence. Obviously, they pushed Bam Bam huge in the main event, but that ended up being nothing. The Young Stallions and the Killer Bees are the survivors in the gigantic tag team match, and they were just in the opening Battle Royal at WrestleMania 4.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing, particularly with these first few that we're going to go through. This is like, they really do establish an identity for the show. Outside of maybe the occasional Battle Royal, this is probably the only real show until Royal Rumble where you'd see a mass of talent in one ring at any one point. Particularly with this 87 one, though, where it kind of begins. As far as I'm aware, you didn't really see much of that in the WWF, so it was quite a spectacle.
It was a gimmick
for the show, but it was a gimmick that you didn't see anywhere else, and so it was exciting to see probably names that wouldn't necessarily tag team together because they were solo wrestlers being teamed together, and you know, a lot of convergent storylines being mixed in. It was a great way of ending storylines and starting storylines all by mixing certain characters together. So
yeah, and again, just think, you know, for those at the time, that the pace of the television show was a lot slower, so you didn't get to see the star element that we got here. Any thoughts on this show in particular? The Jumping Bomb Angels match. There's a women's Survivor Series match on this show. I like the Jumping Bomb Angels who got over, but I've been waiting 58 episodes to say Rockin' Robin is the fucking shits. I honest to God, I've been waiting to get that off my chest for so long. But yeah, just a horrible effort from Rockin' Robin, topped only by the national anthem she did at WrestleMania 5.
Oh God, I forget about that. Every time that you bring that up, it's just like a sharp reminder in my... Oh God, no. Awful, just awful.
The Jumping Bomb Angels were the clear standouts, just due to like all the kind of the flips and the spots that they were doing. Commentary team, which I think was that Gorilla and
Jesse the Pilgrim Ventura, as he should have been called.
Beautiful Jesse. Yeah, I just remember like him putting over the Jumping Bomb Angels like hell, just thinking like, oh, these are great.
These girls are women's division.
Yeah, these two girls are actually really good.
Yeah, I and the one thing that I want to mention on the show specifically, because we only saw it in this one and the year afterwards, but the gigantic tag team match, the big tag team survivors. I absolutely love these matches.
I thought they were absolutely brilliant. I mean, I think the one the following year is superior to this one.
I do too.
But yeah, we talk about sort of the novel concept of the Survivor Series as a show, and the fact that in itself bit the dust so early on in the history of the event. But it was great. Just the sheer, God, it almost sounds like I'm stealing a line here, but sort of the sheer mass of humanity around the ring. It just creates a happening.
It was a happening,
you know, the irresistible force meeting the immovable object almost. But it
right
was
in the breadbasket.
Just a sight to behold at the time, and you look back at some of the teams that were involved. I mean, you'd have had long odds on the Killer Bees and the Young Stallions being the two teams that survived from it, but you know, you look at some of the talent. You got the British Bulldogs in there, Demolition, not so much the Bolsheviks.
No, not so much.
You know, the Hart Foundation, the Rougeaux, you know, you got...
Didn't sleep on the Islanders either. Tama was good.
Tama was good, and just I was finding it strange. It was sort of here today, gone tomorrow with them, wasn't it?
Yeah. But, what about the dream team, Carl?
Oh, the fucking Dino and Valentine.
The team of my nightmares, let's say. But no, a really, really interesting concept again.
If one member of the team was eliminated, the
they
team...
both were.
Yeah, that did grind my gears.
What, the yeah. both members being eliminated?
Yeah, yeah. I don't know why, it just always did. Yeah. They've just got a nice skin.
Yeah. Can you imagine that, though? Like, everybody has to get eliminated? That
oh, well, obviously, fucking, yeah.
They were long enough anyway. They gave those matches a lot of time, too.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, it's four matches on the card.
For those of us who had the VHSs, we did get shafted on them and only got... two-hour edited versions.
Yeah, and that'll become particularly annoying the next year on the Coliseum video release. Yeah.
In fact, I will say, just as an aside, on this 87 edition, the VHS doesn't actually show you some of the eliminations from the tag match.
Yeah, and thank God the network's got them all. But on the Dewey release, it's like just the team just kind of vanish out into thin air. Because they don't even do the screen wipe, if I remember right, do they? It's just that they cut to something else and all of a sudden the team's not there.
They might do.
Pretty much, all of a sudden the Bulldogs are just gone.
Yeah. Also, can I just one last thing on this 87? This is a little pop quiz for the people here, right? The opening match had a babyface team, right? Which consisted of Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, Jake Roberts, Jim Duggan, and Brutus Beefcake. Guess which two of the jobbers in that team?
I will say, too, though, the one thing that kind of stood out to me when I first watched this was the fact that, god damn, the fans were so into Bigelow. I was very surprised at how over Bigelow was here. And obviously, it was a great story, the three monster heels at the end, Bundy, Gang, and Andre against Bigelow. But they got Hogan out of there, the kind of shitty elimination there for Hogan that was mentioned in the feedback.
Yeah, the very much the eliminating him while still protecting him move. But that in itself is shocking to think about, isn't it? The fact that Hogan as the champion was eliminated when, you know, all the money in the world you'd have on him being the sole survivor of the teams, and to have Bigelow there as the last man standing is quite a story in itself.
Yeah, they clearly had big intentions for Bigelow.
Do you think that was maybe a lost opportunity to have Bam Bam as the sole survivor there to really kind of build him up?
In hindsight, I would say probably not, because he was gone by Mania was his last show, so I guess maybe not. And Andre, they kind of needed to reheat because there was still so much stock in Andre.
Well, yeah, and you got to remember that the purpose of that match really, and the reason that Andre was the survivor, was to build to the Saturday night's main event in February the following year, I think, is where they do the monster rating for Hogan dropping the belt.
So with that said, a lot of elements in the 87 version that kind of bled over into 1988, specifically with the tag team matches. We're going to get to the 88 show now. Jake Roberts, parole officer from the UK fan forum, says, "We'll always love the 88 Survivor Series that had the 10 tag team elimination match. Survivor Series 88 was my third WWF tape, and I didn't have Sky, so literally to this point I'd only seen Mania 3, the Bulldogs VHS, and then this. Barbarian in particular was a beast in this, and athletic as hell." Really big shoe from the UK fan forum says, "The whole tag team Survivor Series match they had with Demo, Bulldogs, Brainbusters, Powers of Pain, Heart Foundation, etc. On the UK Coliseum VHS, they edited a bit, but that match is in full if I recall correctly. What memory stands out for me is the double turn, Fuji siding with the Powers and the Demos going face. I think they only did those big tag team Survivor Series matches on the first and second annual events, but it's one match they should have kept on with." Bahana from F4W says, "The 88 Survivor Series has a special place for me because it's the first WWF event I watched live on pay-per-view. The part I like is when Rick Rude was gyrating over Jake the Snake, and then Jake pulls his tights down and gives in the DDT. Cagney the Villain from WrestlingForum.com says, "I was 4 years old when I saw that 20-man tag from the Survivor Series 88 and was blown away seeing all those guys wrapped around the ring." And not JTab from Pro Wrestling Only says, "The 5 tag team match from the second series is a long-time favourite. I watched it at a friend's house in early 92 when wrestling was at its peak in the UK, and I was just fascinated by it. There were a few guys I knew, such as national hero Davey Boy, Arn Anderson from WCW on ITV, but so many strange characters I didn't. I became a huge Powers of Pain fan from that match. They looked so badass, especially compared to the demo, who just looked like pudgy guys in silly pants to my 10-year-old self. When it boiled down to Powers of Pain versus the Conquistadors, it felt like the biggest mismatch in the world. I still love the Barbarian and the Warlord to this day, even if I have to accept that one of them is actually a bit crap at wrestling. It's a really great match, too. So many little bits I love. Tully tagging in, deciding he didn't fancy fighting the face he just tagged in, and doing the sneaky walk to tag straight out to the demos is awesome. It's still my go-to sick day comfort match." I'm glad that got mentioned, because when I was a kid, I fucking hated Tully Blanchard for this specific match and that specific moment he just mentioned.
I think one thing we've established so far is Carl's adage from the other week that more actually is more.
Yeah, I mean this match is the best match on this show in particular, and one of the best ones in these early Survivor Series. I mean, not every team that was involved in this match was absolutely stellar, but there was certainly enough with, you know, you mentioned the Power of the Pains, which had a certain kind of, like, they had a look at least. You know, the Rockers, Bulldogs, Demolition, which were fantastic. And then, you know, the Brain Busters and the Heart Foundation, which were mine and Carl's picks for best tag teams. of all time.
Fantastic spinebuster from AA in this match, by the way. Yeah. Along with Tully once again.
Do a bad one, really.
I know, but I mean, I've seen some bad ones when he's wrestling Hogan. But
That's Hogan, for fuck's sake, he's surprised.
A lot of interesting things about this show, though, to me, because the Ultimate Warrior is the sole survivor in his match, and that they clearly had grand designs for him pretty early on. They kind of progressed the Andre-Jake feud in their Survivor Series match, even though Andre gets disqualified. Jake does a great promo afterwards I really like, when he's talking about how, you know, what the hell he's supposed to do, the man doesn't break, that, you know, his hands are huge, he's squeezing the life out of you. Just very classic old-school stuff. And also in the main event, which is actually a pretty fun match, the Mega Powers surviving. We get Hogan kind of putting the moves on Liz a little bit, and Savage kind of notices it and then cuts a promo afterwards, which kind of takes that one step further too. Great stuff.
Yeah, Hogan and those lustful eyes at work. But it was a really great show. Like everyone else around the table, I love the tag match. They're all tag matches, but the tag team tag match. The tag team tag match. I thought was absolutely brilliant. But to your point, Liam, there seems much more of a focus and clarity with this one, I think, as opposed to 87. Not that 87 didn't have its sort of its attention on things, with, you know, we mentioned there about Andre being reheated for the Hogan feud and things like that. But I think 88 is much clearer in that. You mentioned big plans for the Warrior. You get the double turn with the Demolition and Powers of Pain, which is to lead to Mania 5. You got obviously the Mega Powers, which is teasing and leading its way to Mania 5. Jake and Andre leading to Mania 5. So you're getting that sense now of, I hate the phrase, but the start of, let's call it, the WrestleMania season, and the start of the build, and the focus being on those programs leading in.
Yeah, I agree with that completely, because I think the one thing that's kind of stand out comparing 87 to 88, like you said, I was going to bring it up myself, is the fact that 87 felt like, and very much was, a show for the sake of doing a show. It was a big pay-per-view. It was the novelty that they were selling it on. They weren't really doing anything big on that show to progress things. 88, they were thinking ahead. They were thinking, planting seeds.
The first one, he was kind of, you know, you got the least crossover of feud, the existing feuds and stuff. 88, it's much more of a functional purpose to it. Just, who the fuck was Scott Casey?
Scott Casey was a jobber who was not supposed to be in the match. I think he was a replacement for JYD.
Andre's eliminated somehow, but then Andre basically just steps in and basically helps Jake lose at the
end. Andre effectively gets himself disqualified.
He just chokes
the life out of Jake and doesn't break on 5, so he gets tossed from the match. And then
it's 4-on-1. Jake eliminates Rude with the pantsing of the DDT that's been mentioned. Andre loses his shit and chokes the shit out of him. And then Perfect?
Henning comes in for the pin.
Yeah, not yet Mr. Perfect, actually. Kurt Hennig. Mr. Perfect as well?
He was just Kurt Hennig, because they was, even by the Royal Rumble in 89, they're still referring to him as Mr. Perfect Kurt Hennig. So he hadn't quite completely embrace the persona, let's say.
Harley Race rocking up in a rather chic t-shirt, I believe, looking like a megastar, gets the King of King things finished or whatever.
Because, yeah, you mentioned about the Jake Roberts promo at the end. Was this the promo where he's just turned around saying, like, he's now starting to understand how Andre works and, like, what the rules are?
Oh, yeah,
and he's just there going, like, or he goes, okay, you're playing by your rules, you just need to tell me how to play, what these rules are, and I'll play by them. Yeah. And you're just thinking, like, shit, don't tell him the rules. Don't tell this guy the rules, he'll fuck you. You know, it's just like, this guy's the wrong person to tell the rules to.
One of the things that they really got on the kick with very early on is the cheap eliminations. And we certainly get a few from here with the Twin Towers both being disqualified. Andre disqualified. Bad News Brown, always a staple in these Survivor Series matches, blows up on his team and just walks off.
Yeah, I absolutely hate the fact when you've got so many, you have jobs, so many people, like, cheap finishes. Look, back then it was fine, because, yeah, as you say, the concept of so many guys in close proximity you wouldn't normally see on TV at that time, you get away with a few to protect certain guys.
One of the staples I didn't like about Survivor Series, when the vast majority of a babyface team wins. I just never liked that. I didn't mind it if like a heel team, like two or three other heel teams survived in the end, and, like, you know, because they just dominated, they cheated, whatever. But for some reason, like, I'm looking at the Randy Savage, Ricky Steamboat, Jake Roberts, I never liked it when the babyface team was completely dominant. I guess it's probably because it's me being a heel lover. It's just like, I always just kind of thought, well, that was a shit team then, wasn't it? They couldn't even...
Well, it's not exactly conducive for drama and conflict, is it, if your babyface is just kicking ass? But, yeah, you know, when you're doing these shows, how many, 28 years? You know, you've got to mix it up a bit. You can't go sole survivors, 2-on-1 heels, babyface comes back and wins every single time or something like that. You know, you're going to mix it up.
Moving on here to 1989. Some great stuff here in the feedback. WWF Chili from the UK fan forum say, I say Survivor Series 1989 VHS intro. Oh yeah, this bad boy. Jim Johnson's Take a Seat Lady sex sacks brings us shots of Chicago looking bloody freezing and some genuinely interesting backstage footage of the WWF that I found fascinating. Then, as it is a Thanksgiving tradition, a roll call of what the lads are thankful for. The beauty of this, all the colour, the gimmicks. I found out Piper ain't no Ricky Rude, the genius is the world's smartest man, Jim Duggan has a proper bong eye, and the Warrior Talks a heaving bag of balls. Then, as if it wasn't already great, the classic logo whooshes on the screen and the Vin Man himself pipes up, reeling off the lads in teams with team names and absolutely throwing his throat doing it. You can practically hear him react to whichever female ref is sucking him off as he records it. Hercules and the Earthquake! Bliss. Everything, I mean everything about this is the winner. Throw in a fun show to boot and you have a classic. One of my fondest things in wrestling ever. It literally defines what the WWF was. Perfect. Bad news, Gert from TPWW says, the Survivor Series promo from 89, where all the wrestlers say what they're thankful for this Thanksgiving. It's just so campy and wonderful. My Facebook status every Thanksgiving for the past 8 years has been, I'm thankful for Damien and the DDT. Anybody Thriller from TPWW says, my favourite is Roddy Piper saying, I'm thankful I'm not Ricky Rude, then blowing a kiss at the camera. I thought that was hilarious as a kid, and I guess I still do now. North Sea Tiger from the UK fan forum says, for me, it's the Hogan team versus DiBiase team from 89. The pop that Jake got, followed by Demolition, then by the Hulks, they were all insane. Each pop got loud as their music hit, and I wondered at the time if the crowd could get any louder. Decent match too, although I hated Hebner grabbing Zeus like that and then DQing him. He really was an attention-seeking twat. Lord of the Drums from F4W says, the Hulkamaniacs versus Million Dollar Team. The Powers of Pain get DQ'd for being bad, and Zeus gets DQ'd for kicking too much ass, yet it still comes down to Hogan and DiBiase in the end. Wacky, but a fun time. Grimace from Pro Wrestling Only says that 1989 is my favourite show ever. From the amazing What Are You Thankful For open to the great, great, great Warriors versus Heenan Family main event, the whole show is just fun. It might be Gorilla and Jesse's greatest night as well. Plus, it's the only night with a perfect format of 4 versus 4 all night with no stupid finals match. And Jerry Von Kramer from Pro Wrestling Only says the match with Heenan stepping in for Tully, which is a great effort in the main event from Heenan, just great stooging and douchery from Bobby Heenan, coming in, getting one punch of the gut and tagging back out, just class stuff from Heenan here. It was mentioned there in the feedback, the team names, which I love about the Survivor Series. That needs to make a return.
Yeah, I mean, this show is very much to me, and a couple of the emailers references it there, it's the WWF in its sort of most camp sort of pomp, if you like. By the time you get to 89, you've got all the crazy gimmicks just on show in the first 3 minutes of the pay-per-view when they're doing their introductions of what they're thankful for. You know, we've gone from this point to the 5 teams down to the 4 teams yep. Now at this point. I'm not sure if that's just a question of roster depth or what the reason behind that was.
And I'm guessing, by the way, this is the first Survivor Series without the big giant tag team match, and I'm guessing that's very much the same reason.
Yeah, you would imagine so. Though it's strange as well that the fact that they decided to split up some teams, and you know, the Hart Foundation aren't together as an example.
Yeah, that was weird.
Really strange on that to me. But
a couple of replacements on this show as well there.
Yeah, a couple of replacements. The emailer referenced about the Earthquake, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, Liam, but he's a late replacement for Barry Windham.
The Widowmaker.
Who may or may not have had some legal troubles at the time. I couldn't possibly comment.
Oh, look at the team that they're facing, Carl.
The 4x4s?
Right. Duggan, Hart, Ronnie Garvin and Hercules. I have never felt more sorry for Bret Hart in my life.
Well, let's just say that, you know, Survivor Series hasn't always been the kindest event. More on that later.
By the way, on that note, the sight of Bret Hart jogging to the ring with a 2x4 in his hand.
Oh my god, yeah, Jesus Christ.
What a poor bastard.
And you must have known this team was just absolutely on fire when they start trying to throw the boards to each other and Duggan drops it. It's like,
we've all seen those eyes.
Didn't fare well against the King's Court here. I thought this is actually a great performance from Savage.
Savage was great. What always struck me about that match was the pops that Bret was getting whenever he was tagged in.
Oh yeah.
And Monsoon's going out, always going out of his way to praise him, and Jesse as well. So you know, you got the sense of the sort of the boys having a real lot of stock in Brett.
Even early on, even 87, Gorilla Monsoon's gone out of his way to call Brett the Excellence of Execution and talk about how great Brett Hart is and how much he's improved and stuff like that.
But it is a fun show. I don't quite share the emailer's joy for Rude's Brood against Roddy's Rowdies.
I'm not sure if anybody was really bigging that up, to be quite honest.
The match is awful, but though on paper, the heel team looks good.
The heel team looks good. Fucking babyface promo beforehand with Roddy's Rowdies, that fucking rogues gallery.
I know, real bunch of no-marks with turkey bones sticking in everywhere. Jimmy Snooker looking like the police are after him again. But you mentioned about replacements there. I wonder if you'd just like to mention why Bobby Heenan was doing his outstanding shift that night.
Because Tully Blanchard just fancied like doing a little coke. That's all I got. And he made the match too. Although, actually, interesting to note here, this is obviously before Mania 6, Warrior goes on last, which I always thought was an interesting thing about this show, the fact that Hogan didn't get to close the show doing the posing routine.
Again, this is all part of building up to
Mania 6,
yeah,
put Warrior on that level. Yep. And I think the backstage segment needs to be mentioned here as well with the ambush with Sherry throwing cocaine in Beefcake's face.
Well, Beefcake shouldn't have left it lying around, should he?
Poor old Tully was feeling hard done by there, wasn't
he? Don't waste it.
Yeah, so there's a run in as well.
He's just sweeping it up.
Yeah, that's one of those guys hit the scene to try and break it up.
They're all doing lines on Hogan's bald head.
The only thing I would say is we mentioned about 88 and a clear direction there. I don't think that's quite the same for 89, frankly. There's nothing that really comes out the Warrior match, the Piper and Perfect match. You know, there's no feud to carry over into Mania by that point. Dusty and the Boss Man, again, is something that by the time you get to Mania, Dusty's in his program with Savage and Boss Man's turned face.
Although, there's one more thing I want to mention here. In the Hogan match, a great soliloquy from Jesse Ventura after the outcome.
Oh, wonderful rant, yes.
Yeah, this stinks. You're paying the referee off. And Zeus, by the way, we have to mention the human wrecking machine Zeus here. This is when they were really thick on the Zeus kick, because of no holds barred, as you mentioned there, Carl. I never liked this. Even as a kid, I thought, this just sucks.
Well, no, and it doesn't shock me to hear you say that, as I know you were no great fan of Yokozuna in his nerve hold, so I can't ever picture you being a big fan of Zeus and his chokehold or the neck wrench.
Oh, yeah.
Let's say, you know. Zeus, you almost don't want to speak ill of someone who's dead.
He died.
He's not dead, is he? Is he?
Yeah, he's dead.
When did he die?
Hang on a second. I need to look into this.
I know it was a few years ago, but still. That's...
Okay, let me have a look here.
He was shit as a wrestler. I quite liked him in films.
Tiny Lister is, in fact, still alive. a real WWE.
Well, I tell you what, if he ends up dead in next week, we know who to look towards.
I stand by my remarks.
He's dead to Carl.
A real Corporal Kirshner WWE.com retraction should be in order here, I feel. Moving along now to 1990, the fourth edition of this show. MLev76 from F4W says, in 1990, they had each of the elimination matches filtered into an ultimate elimination match where the survivors squared off. Not sure who was on the heel team, but the face team was Hogan, Warrior, and Tito Santana. The promo prior to the match was awesome, for no other reason than watching Tito trying to fit in with the other two maniacs. That and Hogan calling Tito the Ariba Man.
The signs were there then, folks.
Matt D from Pro Wrestling Only. I rented Survivor Series 90 so many times as a kid. I think what stands out the most is how surreal the Hogan Warrior Tito promo is. I started watching only a little bit earlier, so I think my lifelong admiration of Tito came in part because I thought he was still a main eventer. Air Raid from UK Fan Forum says, the second time I ever saw the Hart Foundation wrestle was on the 4th annual Survivor Series. The match seemed to take on extra meaning for Brett when Roddy Piper on commentary poignantly told us that his brother Dean had passed away the day before and expressed his admiration for Hart's professionalism and that he dedicated the match to Dean. Air Raid actually did a sensational poster where he kind of broke down the match bit by bit, and now it was Hart left with the three guys, but this time the babyface didn't go over. DiBiase wins in the end, and Raid follows it up by saying, I was crushed. Brett had won me over as a hero in showing spirit when the odds were against him, and then pushing such an established technician and sometimes main eventer to the brink, but in the end it was a bridge too far. It was obviously an important lesson that not all stories have a happy ending, but I felt awful, not just because the guy I wanted to win didn't and that the underdog didn't quite prevail, but I felt bad for Brett, despite him being just the character in the wrestling. Brett Hart, the courageous loser, brought a lump to my throat. It was actually a fantastic performance comments from Brett. Arrogantly Grateful from Wrestling Form says, when Rick Martel walked out in the 90s Survivor Series team when they got into the final bout was beauty. He just basically said, I've had enough, and left his team to pick up the pieces. Also, I think the obvious one, The Undertaker's debut. With DiBiase more so, because I'm a bigger fan of DiBiase than I am Taker, but I felt it was a great rub Taker got there by being introduced by DiBiase. Of course, they had Brother Love with him at that point, but I feel the introduction and build-up from DiBiase was awesome. The gobbledygooker, the less said, the better, though. B-Papa from F4W says, Taker's debut was the perfect age for me to be like, oh, I'm too old for this cheesy stuff. Whoa, wait, this is pretty spooky. Green Lawler from Wrestling Form says, obviously, Taker's debut is number one. That was really cool seeing the former Mean Mark Callis, Punisher, get his break. Second, I would say Slaughter's Survivor Series debut. Knowing that the Sarge, even though his team lost, was getting over as their number one heel. Bellino from Wrestling Form says, when The Undertaker delivered his first ever tombstone in the WWF to poor Coco Beware, I thought Coco was dead. Spartan from the UK Fan Forum says, 1990 was the first Survivor Series I ever saw, having borrowed it on tape from a mate and taken it to a 24-hour War Games marathon being held at my school. We didn't have Sky at the time, so my regular wrestling viewing was basically WCW Worldwide on ITV, which I would record and watch before school. I remember thinking the first match was poor and Animal's punches were missing by miles. Quite embarrassing. Things picked up for me when DiBiase introduced his mystery partner. This was the first time I'd ever come across a wrestler who I was used to seeing on another show jump ship and be wrestling for the competition. I, of course, proceeded to play the know-it-all and proclaimed to my mates that it was just Mean Mark Callis from WCW, he was shit, and they probably brought him in to fight Hogan, and we'll never see him again after that. Good call.
Yeah, I think this is probably, in terms of a show as a whole, this is the first one that kind of, like, I don't like. I mentioned it earlier about, like, them trying to find different ways of doing this show, and already four shows in, they're trying to find something new.
Yeah, what a great way
to do.
More jobbers.
Yeah. but it's just, they had Hogan and Warrior, which is like, you know, Jesus Christ, you could bet the house on those two getting into the final. But, like, Tito Santana just kind of being feeling randomly there. And then just looking at the heels, I mean, with the exception of kind of DiBiase, just Martel, Power and Glory, Warlord, it's just a bit of a mismatch. I mean, like, there's little things throughout the show which I don't like. Like, for instance, like the opening match, you have both the WWF champion and the IC champ, Kurt Hennig, in there, which I don't like. I think, like, if they had to do the storyline, I think I'd have preferred it if Kurt was in a different match and survived and ended up in that final spot. So at least it kind of gives something to the IC champ. I don't know if you guys will agree, maybe that'll be even bigger a jobber for him. Yeah, we can all talk about the Bret Hart performance. You know, I think that was great and all, and you know, there were other individual performances that did well. I think I'd rather saw someone like Bret Hart rather than Tito in that kind of final bit, even if he ended up being the only one that gets eliminated from his team.
Yeah, the drama's not as good though if he doesn't almost get the victory. I think that's kind of the key. It's like he was 3-1 down. Taker gets counted out, he gets the pin on Valentine, and then it's him and DiBiase 1-on-1, and he comes close like 3 times to getting the victory, and then in the end DiBiase just catches him, cradles him, that's it. And Brett just mouths fuck. Like, it was just great. And Air Raid mentioned that as well in that great post that I suggest everybody go and look at, because it was really good.
Yeah, it's a wonderful sort of tease, if you like.
Yeah, it's the coming down to the wire and almost getting it. If he just gets eliminated in the match, then there's the drama, the same drama's not there.
I mean, I will say, G, bell to bell, I'm not the biggest fan of this show outside of the Brett performance.
Yeah, I'll go along with that as well.
The concept for that final elimination match is, I appreciate the idea of trying to do something different, just trying to keep it a bit more fresh as best they can. But it was ill-devised. It wasn't really explained in the build-up to the show. It wasn't really explained particularly well during the show either. You know, there's no sort of, if you picture the King of the Ring and the brackets, that sort of thing, you don't get any feel for who's going to be on which team. You just know that all these people are advancing to an elimination match. You don't know what the teams are going to be, to the best of my knowledge. And there's no tangible reward for surviving either. Yeah. So it's nice to sort of try and freshen it up, but this was an ill-conceived and ill-executed plan.
Okay. I think more than anything else, that it exposes the big problem of 1990, which is there were no heels with heat. Yeah. I think that's the big takeaway from this. And you can see, and it's funny because Sergeant Slaughter doesn't even win his match in that fuck awful match we mentioned last week, the Alliance versus the Mercenaries. That pile of dog shit.
I'm going to say, you want to talk Rogues Gallery, that one's a real Rogues Gallery. And of course,
doesn't even win, he gets disqualified. And not only does he get disqualified to get eliminated, Tito had him beat. He's the world champion in 2 months.
like you say, it's the lack of heat on heels, other than what would have been Earthquake just prior to that at SummerSlam. It is a consequential show in the sense of you get the Undertaker's debut.
Now, what was it, four shows in, and they're mixing it up, looking for a fresh gimmick. I think now, kind of, already for me, the writing's on the wall with Survivor Series as a concept, as a show. It's a gimmick show, but largely irrelevant.
Yeah.
You get, you know, the occasional isolated thing, like Hogan Savage, which had a big functional reason, but mostly it's mixed match of guys who already infused together, just pushing things along. It's a concept show with little relevance, and I think that as we go on into, you know, then in, through the years, I think the writing's on the wall from an early stage, really. Maybe from its very conception itself, put together just to fuck with Crockett. So maybe it was not, the writing was on the wall from the very first year. But in terms of longevity, I think now it's really there to see that. In terms of its place, it's nice. It's a bit of history and, you know, and tradition. But in terms of relevance, I think they're already struggling to keep it relevant, even at this early stage.
I can understand in the end why they put, you know, people like Martel and Warlord and Power and Glory in there, because basically what that last match ends up being is
cannon fodder.
It's squash match.
But who really believed Hercules had a chance against Hogan and Warrior at the end? You know?
Well, yeah. But before we leave this 1990 show, I'll possibly leave it to another member of the panel if they wish, but it does have to be remarked on the individual performance of one Terry Bollea in that last match.
Oh, the fact that he fucking jumps in and makes the count along with Warrior at the end. Oh, and I thought the fucking cheap shot on Warlord at the start too.
The spotlight must always shine on the glistening bald head of Hogan.
How did the Undertaker get eliminated?
He went after dusting that Canada.
Yeah, they could have done that in the end. He could have at least survived the first match. Everyone's like, oh shit, he's a threat. How is he going to deal with Ultimate Warrior and Hogan? What's going to happen there? And then do it in the main event. There was certainly a better heels that they could go to if they wanted to try and do a much more interesting main event.
But with someone like Taker, it's the debut, it's the tease. You're giving you a taste of something. You don't want that clash with Warrior or Hogan on the first night, at least to my mind.
Hogan, Duggan, Big Boss Man, Tugboat, Earthquake, Dino Bravo, Haku, and the Barbarian. Whoever booked that, I hope you get AIDS. Because that's fucking atrocious. And two, the gobbledygooker.
To be mentioned. Roddy Piper has never had less credibility, God rest his soul, than when he talked about how great it was to see the gobbledygooker farting around the ring with Gene Okerlund, or the crowd, God bless them, wherever they were, just booted out the building.
And Piper may have been partaking in some recreational activities prior to the show, perhaps just to give himself a bit of a boost, and maybe that clouded his judgment when it comes to the gobbledygooker.
Funny there, though, that we talked about 1919, how they seem to be reaching for something. 1991's landmark in the sense that now, at this point, what are they using to draw at 1991? It's not the Survivor Series matches, and it's evident in the feedback here what's memorable about this show. Vic Capri from WrestlingInformed.com: the Undertaker defeating Hulk Hogan at Survivor Series and becoming a legend overnight. Suit23 from Pro Wrestling Only says Taker pinning Hogan is his fondest memory. This was the first shocking finish I remember watching. Thanksgiving was a dampener the next day for this little Hulkamaniac. I'm sure you felt the same way, Carl. The Brain Follower from Pro Wrestling Only: I was a huge classic horror fan, so The Undertaker I really liked as a kid. I was cheering like nuts when he beat Hogan, whom this 12-year-old had grown on. I had exactly 2 days in school to crow over it until Hogan got the belt back, but at 48 hours I was in my little heel glory. Mifuni Jackson from WrestlingForum.com says Undertaker versus Hogan is up there. Taker was an amazing character in his first year, and Hogan seemed like he had all the momentum at the time, so Taker beating Hogan was really unexpected for me. And Theo Diaz from TPWW for his fondest memory says, very simply, Hulkamania is dead, long live The Undertaker. It spans a year for me. I wasn't seeing pay-per-views live much back then, especially not around Thanksgiving, which we spent in a cabin with a non-pay-per-view compatible TV aerial antenna. That takes you back. I wasn't that excited about DiBiase's mystery partner, who I was convinced was Randy Savage, given his heel history with DiBiase and not too old feud with Dusty the year before. So when I saw the next Superstar show and saw the recap of The Undertaker's debut, I was shocked that it was a brand new wrestler and was instantly enamored with this zombie-esque slow-walking giant that planted Coco on his head. A year later, I was bored of Hogan and really mad that he was going to steamroll the guy I had been cheering for a year. So tuning in to see The Undertaker holding the precious WWF belt was absolutely thrilling for me. His reign may have been short, but I was equally delighted when On the Take Tunney, the best president since Noriega, vacated the belt to set up the best rumble in history. Hell, even Hogan's beating with a handful of cremated human remains to the face was wholly entertaining to me. There's your American hero, whining, cheating, desecrator of the dead. But the big story here, obviously, not the Survivor Series matches. It's the Gravest Challenge, Taker and Hogan, which was built up well, I think, and the crowd in Detroit.
It wasn't a full turn on Hogan, but there are noticeable cheers when the ref counts to three.
Even for his entrance music, they're cheering him straight away.
There's signs there of a waning, if you like, when it comes to Hogan's popularity.
It's this is post Arsenio Hall, and he's been getting booed on some house shows.
It's the selling point of the show. It's not the Survivor Series matches themselves, which I'll get to in a moment,
because
they need discussing.
Yeah,
but this is this was the first pay per view I ever saw.
Ever.
In fact, yeah, obviously we didn't get them live at the time over here. We got them on Sky Movies Plus a couple of days later. So I remember watching it on like a Thursday tea time, something like that. So the first, imagine me as a small kid being a Hogan fan, the first pay-per-view I see is Hogan losing the belt. And the shock of that and the sort of the stark image of Taker dragging the belt down the aisle after he's won is really, it's one of those moments that sort of has never gone away from me, really. The other thing to mention about it, that is that it shows the sort of the piss take, if you like, of Vince McMahon, that the entire pay-per-view is sold around this world title match, and it's solely for the purpose of them trying to string in another pay-per-view 48 hours later. The greedy bastard with Tuesday in Texas. But yeah, it's a strange show as well.
It's awful.
In the sense that, but it's in the middle of the show.
Yeah,
it's the middle of the card. I can only assume they did that because they wanted to send the crowd home happy, in theory, with the Legion of Doom going over in the final match. But let's talk about the roster depth, because we mentioned it before in Breakaway from the tag matches. You look at the roster depth here, and there's one match in particular that sticks out to me like a sore thumb.
So just before you read it out, Carl, can I just say, can I make an amendment on what I stated with the Hogan match on the last show? Whoever booked these three Survivor Series matches that I'm sure Carl's going to read through, you're the one that deserves the AIDS, because these three tag matches are absolutely the shit.
Well, let's talk about there's obviously four Survivor Series matches, the last one of which only has three members on each team because Sid and Jake aren't there. And Jake gets to cut his promo on the
wearing
outstanding jumper, it must be said, and horrible leather trousers.
It's like an amalgamation of Owen Hart at SummerSlam 93 and Judge Reinhold from the Santa Claus. That whole fucking colourful jumper he would wear. Good promo though. Obviously this is after the snakebite angle.
The team of Jim Duggan, Sergeant Slaughter, Kerry Von Erich and Tito Santana, who was happy to just still be there.
The Ariba man
himself, the entire team surviving against Colonel Mustafa, who looked vaguely familiar to like someone else from the 80s, but I can't quite place him. The Berserker, the poor man.
God. Don't call him a poor man's Brody.
The complete knockoff of Bruiser Brody, for God's sake. But the shit sandwich doesn't end there, because rounding out the team is Hercules minus Paul Roma and the Alligator Man himself, Skinner.
At least Hercules' arse wasn't blown in the wind like it was in 89.
Yes, let's be thankful for small mercies.
Even the other match, which is like, okay, it's got the Rockers in it, the fucking Nasty Boys and the Beverly Brothers and the fucking Bushwhackers.
Yeah, that's bad on paper. The Nasties and the Bushwhackers, they're just going to stink up the joint. Worse is Gorilla Monsoon's performance in this match, who completely misses the fact that Shawn Michaels has been eliminated and thinks that he's just walked out. He calls Shawn Marty, Marty Shawn. He doesn't know what the fuck's going on in this match. Gorilla is just reading a different page entirely.
In Legion of Doom, they're not the most dynamic workers in the world. You know, they're over, they look good and so on. But, you know, they're with the big boss man. They beat the award-winning team of the Natural Disasters and IRS. You know, you're damn right that they built this entire pay-per-view around the title match, because they had nothing else.
Well, look at the opener. The opener's the interesting thing, though. Ric Flair's first pay-per-view in the WWF, he's the sole survivor in the cheapest possible manner, where everyone's fighting in the ring, everyone gets disqualified all at once, but from Flair, who's lying on his ass outside the ring, so he's somehow the sole survivor. It's like, this, what a fucking gutless. Obviously, this might be the single most gutless finish in the history of the Survivor Series.
I disagree, because they do something similar a few years later.
Partners, I mean, he's got DiBiase, so that's something, but like the team that he's facing, you know, when you're looking at Bret Hart, who's just won the IC Championship like a few months earlier, Roddy Piper, obviously very popular, and David Boy Smith, who
Virgil was at his height of popularity as well.
Virgil's height, you know, so you got four very popular guys. I mean, really, if you looked at that on paper, it doesn't matter whether it was Ric Flair's, you know, debut or whatever. You seriously would have thought that, well, surely the baby faces go over there. It wasn't the best way of putting him over.
No, he didn't put him over at all. That was the whole thing. Yeah. It didn't make Flair look like... And this is the thing, and Meltzer says this all the time, having Flair doing the team promos with these guys, making him just another guy in his first pay-per-view in, really took a lot of the lustre off Flair coming in as the outsider, as the current NWA champion. We move along now to 1992, and it seems appropriate after we just talked about how the kind of struggle and the lack of focus on the tag team matches the year before, because this year, the Survivor Series matches as a concept are completely eliminated. And I remember vividly picking up this video from the old video store, that relic of history, and just being completely confused at the Survivor Series show, reading the back of the case with no Survivor Series matches being advertised. I was absolutely bamboozled by this. This is one of the shows that we got the least feedback on. The Jeremy from FLW says his high point was Yokozuna killing Virgil in 1992.
That Yokozuna, he's for real, man.
Big Bad Mick from Pro Wrestling Only said, loved Bret and Shawn from 1992. Loved the idea of it before it happened, regardless of how good it was, and I think it's still a solid piece of work. The show was predominantly built around the return of Mr. Perfect as Macho Man's partner when the Warrior, he had some personal growth issues.
Yes.
Let's put him that way.
Yeah. We've talked before with 91 about how the team concept is sort of losing focus, and when we looked at the teams that they'd managed to put together that year, we could understand why. You see, at this point, it's just been completely blown up by Vince, so they've sort of thrown their hands up and gone, no, we'll go for a more traditional pay-per-view card. And I must admit, as a child at the time, I hated it. Where's the tag matches? Where's the elimination matches that I love from this show? Because at that point, I didn't really grasp or appreciate the significance of WrestleMania. To me, my two favourite pay-per-views in order were Royal Rumble, followed by the Survivor Series. And yes, okay, we didn't have as many pay-per-views at the time. There was only the four, but just in terms of shows, the uniqueness is what drew me into them, I think. So I really hated the fact at the time that they'd done this, and you can understand why in retrospect, but when you look at the card as a whole again, the nightstick on a pole...
Boss Man!
Yeah, the
Injustice! What a great voice Nails had, you
know? He had a fantastic, a fantastically terrifying voice, and of course by the time they got to the ring, it was truly terrifying. And then you've got Tatanka fighting Rick Martel over some feathers that may as well have just come from a dead pigeon on the side of the road. The real focus of the show that you mentioned there, which is Savage and the return of Perfect against Ramon and Flair. At this point, the emphasis on Flair has really fallen by the wayside. Mm. In a match that I think I'd probably need to watch back, because it's been a long time since I have seen it, but at the time I found really boring, and it just an incredibly long period of time where Savage is in an abdominal stretch, it just bored me to tears. Yokozuna's squash of Virgil
is great.
It's good, and you know, it's the perfect way to introduce Yokozuna by just having him kill someone.
The gasp of the crowd when he takes his robe off at the start, the fact that Virgil goes for a roll-up and Yoko just sits on him, which is just glorious.
Talk about the Money Inc. and Beverly Brothers against the Disasters and Nasty Boys.
Kieran shakes his head off camera in disgust.
What a fucking face combo that is.
Yeah, the Natural Disasters and the Nasty Boys.
I had to do a double take. Was there a babyface team? Or hang on, is that the four heel squads together? No, oh no, that's they're the faces.
Because there hasn't been enough fat people on this card by this point already. Kamala rocks up to rub his belly and have a god awful match with the Undertaker, in which for some reason the production of the show was so piss poor they couldn't get a casket with hinges for the lid. Taker had to stand there and literally nail the lid shut, which took about 10 minutes time and 10 minutes of my life I'll never get back.
This fucking crew, they're probably playing for time, I think.
Yeah.
Well, that's true. They
could have
given it to Bret and Shawn.
Yeah. Just give them an extra 10 minutes, maybe.
But they got a long time anyway. Mm. That's very long.
I remember really loving that match.
I think the match is great.
Yeah. Even if it's just Bret Hart who's only just won the belt, it's still a champion versus champion match. They still should promote it. If you look at the on the front cover of the Silver Vision cassette, it doesn't show Bret or Shawn on the front of it. It just shows Savage and Kurt.
Yep.
When you've just given the belt to someone new, surely you should be trying to get behind them.
This was a very kind of painful used to be turned perfect babyface out of absolutely west fucking nowhere and just stuck him in the match.
Well, yeah, I mean, that face turn comes just off an episode of Prime Time.
Yeah, the wet weasel.
Where they're all sat around the desk and, you know, the decision to put the belt on Shawn at the time is very much sort of flying by the seat of their pants because they wanted Bulldog out of there because, you know, lo and behold, steroids is rearing its head again.
And also, just to mention with Ric Flair, is that Ric Flair was out of the door about, was it roughly 2 months later?
Yeah, he was gone.
It was like January, wasn't it, when he was gone?
Yeah, January, he's out the door. So again, a rather unimpressive show here.
I just want to say again, I've said it a million times, but I think this might have been the match when, watched it back retrospectively, Shawn versus Brett, I had to shake my head and think, what should have been with these two?
The series that they could have had.
For fuck's sake.
Yeah, it's extremely frustrating. A really good match. Slower pace than you would expect in the early going, but it really picks up. And sunny days were ahead for the WWF in 1993 because they decided that Bret Hart was no longer the solution Lex Luger was. And we were going for the Foreign Fanatics against the...
The All-Americans with Freedom Fighter himself, The Undertaker.
Well,
do you remember the reveal on Superstars that he was going to be the team member?
Opens the coat and he's got the flag inside.
That's the one.
Yeah, what the fuck was that all about? Yokozuna, Ludwig Borger, Crush and Jacques.
From the Quebecers.
Quebecer Jacques, because they ended the undefeated streak at the Tonka at the hands of Ludwig, and then they had Pierre get injured by Luger. Atrocious. Tit for tat, if you will. Crowbro from F4W mentions a match here that I want everybody's take on. The Four Doinks. Seriously, as a kid, I wondered how they'd pay it off. In my opinion, the best comic relief match in WWF history. Really, I loved the whole card. Jannetty and Kid surviving was cool. The Hearts imploding was just starting. Took a good piss during the Smoky Mountain tag match. That's diabolical. Doink hijinks and a good main event which set up Taker and Yoko, furthered Savage and Crush, which I always thought was an underrated storyline, and had Lex winning when I was at peak mark mode for him. Late 93, early 94, while in the middle of the 92-96 dark period, has always been one of my favourites. Eras. I do not share those kind sentiments towards the Doink match.
Yeah,
I most certainly do not. It's, you know, as if seeing a crappy Steve Lombardi or Ray Apollo, whoever's playing Doink that night, wouldn't have been bad enough. The fact that we're treated to Men on a Mission and the Bushwhackers.
That's got to be the worst.
In Doink paint and wigs is just absolutely atrocious. And I feel so terribly sorry for Bam Bam Bigelow and the treatment he gets on that evening. I actually quite enjoyed this show. And it goes back to, I mentioned before about how 88 had some, at least there was some focus there in terms of programs going ahead. And 93 for me really returns to that. You've got Razor and IRS being focal points in their teams initially to carry on their feud, which goes into the Rumble. Obviously Brett and Owen, you've got the deterioration of their relationship as it leads to Mania and the programme throughout the whole summer of 94. The Four Doinks and Bigelow's match, as much as I hate it, there's at least a focus there because they're building to the also god-awful match at WrestleMania
yeah,
10
yeah.
And Luger, it's part of the continued push for him, in theory prepping him for the win at Mania and leading towards the Undertaker-Yoko match at the Royal Rumble again. So again, it's a show that's got a real sense of focus to it.
A lot of forward thinking.
It's the start of one of Kurt Hennig's long sabbaticals from the company. He was originally supposed to be in the on Razor's team, and you wouldn't see him again.
Such a perfect partner. He tagged out before the match started, I believe, was Razor's word.
You get the replacement of Savage, which is a great replacement, and they tease the continuing feud with Crush throughout the night, where they've got everyone holding him back because he's trying to get to Crush during the last match. So that's great in itself. So at least something good came from that. And on a real sad note for me, it's the last time that Bobby Heenan does commentary
on a WWF
pay-per-view. They tease partway through the show Monsoon's going to hit him, and then Monsoon stops and Heenan's going to sucker punch him, and then Monsoon turns around just at the right moment. Then the next night on Raw, Monsoon comes, kicks him out of the building, and
my belongings,
and Bobby just breaking at that point and actually welling up. It's just really sad on a personal note for me, because I always missed not having Bobby in the company.
I enjoyed the opener. I thought that, as you said,
the opener's fun.
It said with, you know, 1-2-3 Kid, Razor Ramon, Savage. You know, there's some good stuff there. I will never take a fucking piss break when Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey is on.
You got that right.
For me, the main point on this show, I think, is the Hearts match. This is the first bit of footage that we're going to see played over and over and over again for like the next year. Yanks his singlet
just to confront him and so on. And it's just like, there's nice little, really great subtleties. Brett's not completely innocent in this, because there's almost a bit of like a kind of ego thing with Brett anyway, with the fact that his singlet's different from anyone else. He's got a
captain.
He's captain, so he's got a pink singlet. Everyone else is wearing plain black. So it's just that thing where, like, just little bits here and there where, you know, Brett's obviously the babyface in this, but you can see that they're putting layers in where you can at least understand where Owen's coming from with some of this stuff, where he's not being completely unreasonable. You can see where he's coming from, but he's still being a dick about it. And it's just those little kind of details, and this is the first part of this great feud that I've always loved.
Again, Jerry Lawler, another pre-Survivor Series sabbatical, this time the King out on a sodomy charge of a 13-year-old. So, you know, them's the breaks, what can you do?
13-year-old boy or girl?
Girl.
That's alright.
Speaking of the Hearts match, by the way, with it being Bobby Heenan's commentary on Steve Hart in the Hearts match is fantastic. It's like, hey, bum. It's like, oh, look, he's got a picture of his wife Helen on the back of his jacket. Isn't that nice? And it's like the Boston Bruin. Moving along to 94 again, much like the previous year, they have reverted back to the tag team format, but much like 1991, they've also decided to stick the world championship match in there. Bret Hart versus Bob Backlund. W35TY from the UK fan forum, for his fond memory of Survivor Series, says the opening to this show with a team talks backstage. Drax Spago from the UK fan forum says Diesel turning face at Survivor Series 94 was my favourite moment as a kid. There's nothing wrong with the term being predictable if it, one, makes sense, and two, the crowd want it. If that Diesel had had the belt for a year instead of happy, smiling, blue-eyed Diesel, he might have had a better run. Happy from F4W says, I remember how cool it was when the WWF superstars were in the Thanksgiving Day parade float. Other than Montreal, the moment that sticks out most is 94, Brett versus Backlund. I was 10 at the time, but I bought Owen's Remorse, Hook, Line and Sinker. I even remember saying to my parents how cool it was on Thanksgiving for him to turn good again, only to be swerved. Lockjaw from TPWW says 94 because I had the VHS and watched it a lot. Loved Bob Backlund versus Bret Hart. Also loved the midgets. Who doesn't love midgets? Plus, good Undertaker moment on this show. Watched it a lot. I don't know what happened in any of those other years off the top of my head, so 94 wins.
Because God knows the year before wasn't bad enough, we're now treated to face Doink, Jerry Lawler and six midgets.
Got the great spot where Dink goes on Doink's shoulders to play chicken, and then the Lawler calls the midget in the ring to do the same thing. The midget gets on the second rope, then Lawler orders him down so he can get on the midget's shoulders so that he can fight Doink and Dink. And then the midget falls down and Lawler takes a face bump and says, this is fucking brilliant. That's the best thing. Other than that, I mean, what can you say? We talked about gutless Survivor Series finishes before, Carl. I think there's one here for one of the laziest team names I recall, the Teamsters.
The Teamsters versus the Bad Guys. I understand the premise of it being a vehicle to elevate Diesel in the way he sort of runs roughshod through Razor's team. But things such as, you know, head shrinker Fatu struggling with his boots and it leading to a powerbomb. The entire team ultimately getting counted out. One motion of a 10 count, not each individual counted out.
Not a 50
separately.
Count.
Yeah, not a 50 count, like there should have been. That's a real gutless way to do things, and it's, to me, it's the worst example of gutless Survivor Series booking. I mean, I don't know if people will share my view on this. I think they probably will, but there's something quite surreal about seeing Lex Luger, then captain of Guts and Glory, doing a team talk to the Smoking Guns, Mabel and Adam Bomb.
Yeah. Casket match, Taker's return against Yokozuna. Chuck Norris makes an appearance in Sidekicks, Jeff Jarrett.
This show, just watching this back, the casket match. I can't even think of one casket match I've ever enjoyed. I'm really generally trying to think.
Not Undertaker against Karma?
No.
About Undertaker versus Heidenreich?
Oh, God. It's just
Undertaker versus Mark Henry at WrestleMania?
I mean, maybe the closest to a casket match I ever enjoyed was maybe Shawn Michaels.
Should be.
Just because, you know.
Did you not hear the names I just mentioned?
Yeah, I know. Just because King Kong fucking Why? Bundy.
Bundy, who goes over Luger here with a splash.
Actually, yeah, I've seen somewhere I feel sorry for Luger as well.
Oh, Luger gets sympathy for me in this.
I feel sorry for Luger and Bam Bam.
What a fall from grace. This guy who was wrestling for the WWF Championship at WrestleMania, he's not even wrestling on King of the Ring. He loses to Tatanka at SummerSlam, and then he does the big job to King Kong Bundy here. Carl, I know you've expressed your frustration with this show in the past. I think you said it's one of your least favourite pay-per-views during this era.
Oh, it's most certainly up there. And even me, as someone who's been an arch critic of Luger in the past, can feel a hell of a lot of sympathy for him here. He doesn't deserve that. And this is a company that is really struggling at this point, and it's emblematic in the fact that they put the belt on Bob Backlund. Bret Hart's unfortunate run of bad luck continues at Survivor Series. More on that later.
Kieran, I want to drag you in here for this specifically when it comes to Backlund and Bret, because... what did you think of the Owen Hart performance, crying at ringside to try and get Stu and Helen to throw in the towel? That the whole sympathy played up, Davey Boy lying unconscious for about 15 minutes at ringside. Did you kind of buy this? Did you like this as a way to get the belt off Bret? Or
in retrospect, you know, Owen's just like fantastic, but I just fucking hate this at the time. At the time,
yeah,
it's just purely emotional. It was just bogus. Just, you know, Bret beat my fucking Backlund. It's like, it was, I guess, functional to put it onto Big D's. Still think, you know, individual performance aside, it's just, I hated just the whole concept that Bret could lose to this old...
Stayed in the chicken wing for like 8 minutes.
Was it, yeah.
It's Helen's fault.
It is Helen's
Stu
fault.
Stu wasn't going to throw the towel in.
No, Stu was going to let him rot there.
Yeah. Have some discipline.
I mean, we've been over this before in previous podcasts that, you know, there certainly, there had to be better choices than Bob Backlund.
He was only holding it for 2 days.
I know it was, but it's just...
And on that night, he felt like God.
Yeah, but it's just that notion of just, you know, Backlund beats, you know, Hart. It's just like...
Yeah, and in the context of the whole new generation, it's just wrong.
it's a poor card with poor matches, and as if all that isn't bad enough, it has the horrendous, horrific, appalling commentary team that is Vince McMahon and Gorilla Monsoon.
In terms of roster at this point, is this the weakest?
I think
roster?
So.
Roster, yeah, year by year. I mean,
not... yeah, this is the all-star cast that would do that fucking great Royal Rumble 2 months later, where
they had to reduce the entrance times because there's so much shit.
Which of course segues us nicely to 1995, a show that as much as 94 can be maligned, I think rightly so, I think this one's a little bit underestimated personally. A-Bear729 from F4W says the wild card elimination match in 95 still stands as a fun and interesting match dynamic, and I've never understood why they didn't repeat it at some point. Jorgovan21 from Wrestling Form for his fondest memory is Chaparrito Asari's Sky Twister Press in the women's match, and I'm not even kidding. Nightro from WrestlingForm.com says Bret Hart versus Diesel in 95. Not only was it a great match, but also a great rivalry. Bret and Diesel put on top-notch matches every time they stepped in the ring with each other, and they were the best matches of Nash's career. The build-up was so good, with both men's previous two matches being thrown out due to interference, that their third match had to be contested under no DQ rules, and it worked really well with Bret getting more and more violent and sadistic in the match before faking Diesel out and using a small pack to end his 1 year run with the title. It was good psychology, and we would see the return of the monster badass Diesel following the match. And Max Power from the UK Fan Forum says, I'll give the nod to Diesel and Bret from 95. The ending to that really stands out in my eyes. Firstly, Bret going through the table, and then Nash, after getting rolled up for the pin, screaming, fucking motherfucker, when all eyes are on him. He then went nuts, and in one night developed into the character he should have been all year. Probably the first sprinkle of attitude. So thoughts on 95, because I think, like I said, underestimated show, really, really enjoyable stuff.
Bret Diesel just being, again, another solid encounter. I don't think it was the best match those two have ever had together, but again, Bret always seemed to bring out the best in Nash in terms of these matches. Thinking of, I'm trying to think maybe the Rumble might have been the best one.
I think this is the best.
You think
personally.
This is the best one?
I think this has got the finish. So
I remember the Bulldog, Shawn, Armour Johnson and Sid versus Ramon, Dean Douglas, Owen Hart and Yokozuna.
The wild card match.
Having some sort of kind of merit to it. But the only one that really just befuddles me is this super team of Undertaker, Savio Vega, Henry Godwin and Fatu, because they all have like something in common.
The BSKs.
Yeah, versus Mabel, Jerry Lawler, Isaac Yankum and for his first Survivor Series appearance, Hunter Hearst Helmsley. What the fuck was that match about?
That was
where
the
these guys coming?
That was the Taker's crew, is it?
Yeah, that's Taker's backstage. Legit backstage.
That's his click.
So Undertaker, guy who's supposed to be like the cornerstone of the company, and his crew are Savio Vega, Henry Godwin, and Fatu.
And Yoko.
Yeah, but let's be clear on this. Whilst we may not have the highest opinion of them in-ring, I'm not fucking with any of those people. Yeah. No, I'll fight Sean Waltman or Triple H before I go near any of them.
And let's be honest here, that was a one-sided squash. Anyway, Taker kills the entire team.
It's a vehicle to really emphasise Taker's return. So.
And the combination of Jerry Lawler's singlet, which looks like an Indian restaurant wall, and his mullet is fucking beautiful on this show, and is a sight to behold, and is worth the price of DVD in its own right. The Underdogs versus Bobby Donner's match on this show needs to be discussed, because I love that match.
I think it's great. When it comes to this show, and we think of 95 as a particular dark period, I've spoken before about my hatred of the Rumble from that year, the King of the Ring from that year. WrestleMania was just a complete shower as well. This is the one sort of shining example that stands out above all the other shit. It's the one good thing from the pay-per-view calendar that year for the company. Three really enjoyable matches for me, with the opener, the wild card match, just because it's interesting, it's unique. You know, it serves a purpose in getting Ahmed over, and the world title match, which I'm with you on this. I thought it was the best, the best of their three. The psychology, you know, I've talked before about Brett's excellence when it comes to storytelling, and this is just another great example of it. But yeah, that opener is a hell of a lot of fun.
Hell of a lot of fun. The women's match isn't bad either in terms of showcasing Aja Kong. If not mistaken, Mike Chioda completely fucks up the counts on several occasions, and people get eliminated when they're not supposed to. So it completely throws the match off kilter. But it's still a good demonstration for Aja Kong. Had that kind of Vader fear for me as a kid when I saw it for the first time. So that look, Jesus Christ, that backhand at the end when she fucking just kills.
Absolutely potatoes, 100 blades with it, yeah.
Spinning back fist as well.
The spinning back fist, yeah, great stuff there. But he just pretty much fed Bigelow to Goldust. Bigelow got like no offense.
Bigelow gets next to no offense. He doesn't even get much of an entrance.
No.
Whilst
we got to talk about this!
Whilst he's having his entrance, Todd Pettengill is doing an exclusive interview ringside with the esteemed guest, which is President Clinton.
Oh, no, no, no. Oh, God.
With Sonny in his lap.
Not to mention Sonny later in the show, shades of Monica Lewinsky there.
Oh, God. Why did they like this guy? They had him at WrestleMania 10 as well, and it's, I don't know.
Vince just thought it was hilarious himself.
Of course he did.
I guess they just went for the topical time because the show was being held in Washington.
Yeah.
Oh, you weren't a fan of the old Flintstones joke when Pettengill asked his opinion of Bam Bam?
That was awful. Oh yeah, I like Pebbles and the whole family. Move along now to 1 year later, 1996, a show that has a lot of merit on it in its own right, and a lot of feedback from people who want to chime in with their fondest memories of Survivor Series from this period of time. Derek R. Hubbard from F4W says, Survivor Series 96 was one of the few WWF events available for rent at my local video store. I rented it at least three times before I attempted to make an illegal copy with two video machines. The old Madison Square Garden setup, no matter the event, was awesome. This one was especially memorable, with the opening cityscape for the entrance. The standout match on the card is Austin and Brett. It had a different, more violent and aggressive tenor than anything else on WWF programming during that era. It felt like a fight. From a technical standpoint, it is better than their classic at WrestleMania 13. The Click from WrestlingForum.com says, 96 is probably my favourite Survivor Series of this time period, probably because it was an MSG and that poster is awesome. The opener was pretty solid. Rock debuted that night with a terrible gimmick. That's Blue Chipper right there. Taker and Mankind had another solid match. Shawn told the fans to go fuck themselves as they were sick of his cheesy gimmick. Brett and Austin had an incredible match, and can't forget an appearance by the fake Razor and Diesel either. Great show! John Wayne from F4W says, Austin vs. Brett is his fondest memory at Survivor Series. Lou Pickney from F4W says, I had high hopes for this match that were exceeded. This one gets overlooked sometimes because of their incredible WrestleMania 13 match, but that Survivor Series match was very strong. Meltzer gave it 4.5 stars with good reason. And Vince Verhey from the F4W message board, Vinny V, says that he thought the Survivor Series match was better than the WrestleMania match as well. Walking Dead Man from WrestlingForum.com says his fondest memory is Undertaker's return at 96 with his favourite look against Mankind. Supremo from UK Fan Forum says, I have fond memories of Shawn versus Sid at Survivor Series. I was 12 at the time, arguably old enough to know better, but I remember being fucking furious when Sid hit Jose Lothario with that camera, then won the belt from Shawn. I don't think it was shown live at the time, was it? Maybe on a week's delay and screened at prime time? I remember being almost too angry to go to bed afterwards, such was the injustice I'd just seen. Ah, to be young. Amiga919 from the F4W board says, Sid Vicious versus Shawn Michaels at Survivor Series is seriously one of my favourite matches ever. proof of just how goddamn great Shawn Michaels was. Haphazard from the FOW board says, love the crowd split for Shawn versus Sid, and it was organic, not forced like it is now. A babyface match where the crowd split almost entirely into men for Sid and women and kids for Shawn. The screaming and crying as the referee counted three was incredible, and that was just me and Kieran here in England. V Banano from FOW says, I was MSG for this, and the ending was a great moment, probably my favourite Survivor Series memory too. And the Condor from TPWW says, the MSG crowd during the main event, Sid really was the ruler of the world that night.
I really feel that given what happened in the main event on that show, that Kieran should have the first stab at discussing this one.
I think that's fair. Yeah.
So split, so proud of what Shawn could achieve with that fucking 7-foot piece of shit broom. So very disappointed. So very disappointed that he lost. So angry with the New York crowd for their treatment of the great man himself.
What are you people doing? Why are you endorsing Sid? I don't understand.
I don't understand it. And Shawn should never have had Jose there. I knew it was trouble. From the very first start, I knew it was trouble.
Yeah.
No, Shawn didn't need him. Why was he there?
Shawn sure as shit didn't want him there.
Exactly, yeah. No one else ever matched like that with Sid.
No one ever did. I thought this was absolutely brilliant. There are so many spots in this match that I love. Shawn is so smart with this match. Doing the things that he'd establishes, the typical things, is Shawn Michaels nip up and then just turn around to Sid, just running out the corner and drilling him with a clothesline, and the New York crowd explodes. Sid never looked this good before, since.
Ever.
I was so impressed with this match.
This is actually, one of my favourites. It's not my favourite of all time. That'll come in next podcast, but... fond memories of this. I mean, the two main matches are fantastic, obviously, but you know, also there's some merit in these you know, in some of these elimination matches as well. I mean, the Rocky Maivia debut, but yeah, Rocky, he gets that classic match design which I've talked about earlier, which is the one babyface facing the odds of the heel team. And oh, yeah. I just thought it was really like a it's a very simple but a good way of getting Rocky over. It's just a shame that you know, him being over didn't last very long in this guise anyway. Yeah, the Undertaker Mankind match, I remember being a bit strange. I can understand what you're saying, but because Undertaker attire, this is kind of almost predating the Ministry look that he would eventually have 3 years later. But I remember the match being solid, because I think this was the first Undertaker Mankind match that I ever saw. So I kind of like enjoyed the dynamics of that, and just also seeing Paul Bearer hung up in a cage was quite humorous.
Not a big fan of the execution of running at the end. And I gotta say,
no, that was ass.
Yeah, and I gotta say, of all the matches these two had, this I think is by far my least favourite.
And I say this as an absolute Foley mark. It is my least favourite, and I think to call it good would be too kind to it. I wouldn't even say it's average. I think it's a poor match. I think it's a really poor match, possibly because it doesn't go very long. Maybe they struggled time-wise, perhaps.
The crowd just doesn't seem with it.
I don't think, you know, after you've seen, it's almost like booking in reverse, if you like, because they've seen the standard match at King of the Ring, they've seen the Boiler Room Brawl, they've seen a Buried Alive match, and you're then effectively going to a normal match with Bear in a cage, and it doesn't, you know, doesn't quite have that same sort of impact, does it? And the opener, elements of it to enjoy, the crowd are quite dead for it. They don't really know how to react to Furnace and Lafon, in truth. Yeah. I don't feel that the Flash Funk team against Vader team deserves any more time from me than just explaining that it was on the card.
I agree. Although, again, the shift of dynamic from this to the previous Survivor Series, everything they've been building up came to a head in the singles matches here. Taker, Mankind, Austin, Brett, which was huge on television leading up, Sid and Shawn. The Survivor Series matches really don't have much bearing. Rocky, it was just a vehicle to debut Rocky. The one when they debuted Flash Funk was a nothing match. Again, another completely gutless, even more gutless maybe than the 94 one you mentioned, Carl. They just disqualified everybody and the match is over.
We get two eliminations. One's Savio Vega and the other one's Rick Bogner.
Yeah, rightly so.
But the others are almost throwaways as well, as you say. It's the one...
Vehicles, the one being,
in particular, being a vehicle for Rocky whilst Sonny's on commentary double-clicking her mouse. This isn't me trying to pull rank and sort of belittle Shawn, but you could argue that the real sort of main event was arguably Bret Austin, just in terms of how they dedicated TV time to
I'd agree.
And the length of time that you'd had Austin calling him out, and and thankfully it lived up to the hype.
And it's Brett's return too.
Yeah, and it's Brett's return to it's not a church, but it is holy ground at MSG.
The promos beforehand is great.
Brett and Steve put on a clinic.
I still think the WrestleMania 13 match is better, obviously just due to the overall storyline and the double turn. But this
best match
this,
in company history.
Yeah, but this match really isn't far behind.
This is a brilliant
match. It's a hair's length. I mean,
a just, cunt hair away.
It's absolutely everything from like the promos done beforehand. Just little things like Austin's entrance on this, because they got like the skyline on the doors. He does look so fucking badass as he's just bad mouthing to the camera, and it's like, you know, not being an immediate Austin fan like other people here was, this was like one of the first performances I saw from Austin where I was kind of like, oh, okay, I get it, I get what they saw in this guy and why this guy's like fucking like the man now, because he just looks absolutely fucking god in this. And this match, just the way these two guys worked, you know, a lot of people talk about Austin Rock and a lot of people talk about Bret Shawn, but I think the absolute perfect pairing was always Bret Austin. I think those two were the absolute perfect fit for one another in terms of not just their character, but also their style of wrestling. As you know, Austin's doing more of the brawling, and Bret's always been like the master technician. I thought the ending was absolutely brilliant. I don't think it did Austin any disjustice on it. I think he looked strong.
He looked better going out than he did going in. This was the beginning of people realizing, Jesus Christ, this Steve Austin guy, he could be something. No, just watching this match, and I mean, that's the fun part of this show, because I've you know, been told Sid won the belt, which absolutely floored me when I was at school. I watched this show again and again and again, because I loved the furnace and the fun dynamic. Rocky, interesting new guy. Bret and Austin was just a barn burner, and there's no other way to put it. They started wrestling, but it goes into the brawling. Austin hits the stunner, Bret kicks out, so Austin's going to all these other measures to try and win, including putting him in his old sleeper, and it's just great. And Austin walks away, and they make the point, this isn't finished. This isn't the last we've heard of Steve Austin by any means. And he walks away just looking like, he didn't get beaten, he got pinned.
Yeah, the argument that he effectively beat himself.
Yeah.
And Jim Ross is great on the call in that match.
An example of, I'm always been a big advocate of flash pins for like non-blow-offs of feuds and you know, weekly TV, and just it's less final, so it's more fluid you can build to. So,
and not only just, and it wasn't just for variety purposes, it was also to, you know, the poignant part of telling the story. So like, as I said, when reusing this finish, he used it with Roddy Piper because it made sense for them, because he was facing a baby face. And then it made sense again on this because he saw something in Austin, and he's mentioned this plenty of times on his own DVDs and on Austin's DVDs and so on, that he saw something in the guy and blatantly saw, like, we need to leave a thread here. So we need to leave a thread where the Austin, in terms of what his character's like, is not happy with how the match ended, because as Jim Ross states, he pinned himself, and so he's pissed off and he wants another shot at Bret.
Great point there. We move from a Survivor Series that got a lot of play and I think is a really good show from top to bottom to one that is probably the most talked about Survivor Series in history for one match in particular.
Yeah, I don't remember anything.
And the rest of this show isn't worth two squirts of piss as far as I'm concerned. This is, of course, 1997. One person wrote in on this, and that's Shishin KOPF, whose fondest memory was the Montreal Screwjob. It kicked off the Attitude Era and laid the groundwork for Bret Clark to dominate WCW. But this is not my favourite show of all
the
time.
The idiot even had cue cards.
Yeah, had cue cards in the
WCW. What idiot wrote them for him?
Sonny Ono.
Probably Nash, actually.
It was Nash. The Headbangers and the Blackjacks against Billy Gunn, Road Dogg, and the Godwins.
Steers and Queers, apparently.
The Truth Commission against the DOA speaks for itself. Kane's first match on pay-per-view here against Mankind. Steve Austin's return after SummerSlam in what was a 4-minute match against Owen Hart, and of course, the Shawn Michaels Bret Hart main event, which was a great match, actually, until the finish. I really enjoyed that match. A lot more of a different vibe. The fight feel really worked for these two. I really, watching this match back, loved it. At the time, what can you say? I mean, and we'll talk about the mechanics about what happened with the Screwjob in the Monday Night War timeline when we get to that next, because we're talking about the fourth quarter of 97 in the next episode of the timeline. But
what a tease.
What a tease. But I just remember watching this at the time, just with you, Kieran, and just seeing that finish. And I remember just turning to you and just saying, that was the weirdest thing. and I had no idea what it was, and of course the story would come out and we'll get to that at a different time. I didn't really know what to make of it, because if I'm judging this as a standalone show, there wasn't really all that much to enjoy, and the only thing that was enjoyable had just a very bizarre finish.
What else is there to say about the show apart from the screwdriver? It's, you know, goes without saying. I can't remember. Was it just the confusion? Was it just that?
It's what the fuck would we just watch kind of a thing. Yeah, it's what, like, that was that an angle? And yeah. What they're supposed to get across there? I didn't understand what had happened, because obviously Brett gets straight back up, and it's like, okay, well, that doesn't look like that's the finish of the match. It just looked like, honestly, the first thing I thought when I watched it was they ran out of time and they fucked the finish up or something like that. Like, oh, they've run out of pay-per-view time or something like that. So that's all I thought. It was like they just rang the bell early or something like that. That's all I could think at the time as a kid, and it wasn't until the month when Power Slam comes in the mail where it's all explained. But judging this as a standalone show, not much of merit here.
As a standalone show, like you said, there's not an awful lot to talk about here.
Billy Gunn misses a leg drop off the top by about 6 feet in the first match, and that's the finish as well. Billy Gunn just fucking...
No. Like you say, Steve Austin can only go 4 minutes because he basically still got his broken neck. Though testament to how popular he was at the time, bearing in mind, just as a contrast that night to Canadian Stampede, where he's absolutely booed out the building in Calgary, when you get to this show in Montreal, there are noticeable cheers for Austin in Canada, even against Owen.
Yeah.
I don't know if I said this on the Monday Night Raw show at the time, the last one we did, it would have been the last one, wouldn't it? But he was so good at Canadian Stampede, I thought he won the hearts of the Canadians.
Yeah.
Even if their vocal cords didn't replicate that emotion. So I think down the line, it was like, yeah, he's fucking ace. We know how good he is.
Yeah, they're watching TV everybody else is. They know how good he is too. And it's a testament, because like I said, in the Team USA, Team Canada match, they are staunch in favour of Team Canada, very obviously. But again, it's like, there's nothing to take away from this apart from one of the biggest stories in wrestling history.
No. So, like you say, it's also strange to say that there's nothing to talk about on this show. Until you get to the last match.
Yeah.
Much like yourself, confusion is the best word I can think of to describe those events. Because I was 11 years old at the time.
Come on now!
Okay, I was 111 years old at the time. And I didn't really grasp the significance of what was happening. Didn't really understand the significance of what was happening. It just, like you say, it seemed very strange. You've got this... What had up to that point been, I thought, a really fun brawl, which had gone about, 15 minutes, something like that?
Yeah.
And you've got the Canadian crowd baying for Sean's blood. It had all been really enjoyable. Then this just comes out of nowhere. Sean very quickly gets out the ring and is just sort of escorted to the back and, you know, barely celebrates. And I just remember, because I didn't even
Hebner
notice,
breaks the land speed record
at
the back.
You see Hebner bail. I didn't even realise the first time I'd seen it that Vince was at ringside. I hadn't spotted him. You know, you've got JR and Lawler who are just stoic on commentary, so that just adds to the confusion.
Yeah.
And you just get that quick line from JR as the show closes that Shawn Michaels has won the World Wrestling Federation title and Bret Hart is standing in the ring in disbelief.
I did love Shawn, like, acting confused of what had gone on at the finish. Oh, he's so good.
Oh, and he continued that backstage too, didn't he? Oh, it's sickening. Anyway, yeah, but again, as a show, no one's voting for this as their favourite. No one's voting for this for fondest memory. No one's going to vote anything on this show as best match. And I think that sums it up perfectly. With the exception of one of the biggest stories in the company's history, there's absolutely nothing to talk about for the 1997 Survivor Series. Gang Wars. Two more to go, and of course we have a 1998 Deadly Game next on the agenda. Tiger Rick from the UK Fan Forum says, I'd have to go for The Rock's turn at Survivor Series 98. That whole tournament was brilliant and intertwined the whole McMahon-Taker, Kane, Foley, Austin story that had ran throughout the summer. It had several moments of triumph or shock that kept you guessing, and then just when it appeared the feel-good ending was on the horizon, they pulled the rug out from under you. Everyone wanted to love The Rock at that point, but they had a longer-term view and committed to it. It's amazing that they've not done anything similar since, and it's sad that they don't take chances like this these days. And there are no stories with this depth. They peel back the layers of that night. The Clint from the UK Fan Forum says, another shout out for Survivor Series 98 here. It was an awesome pay-per-view. The night was full of twists during the tournament. Going into the event, I was certain Austin was going to win. I have to be honest, I never saw The Rock's heel turn coming, as they only turned in babyface in September of that year. Also a nice heel turn from Shane that night too. XL from TPWW Forum says perhaps the most perfect night of booking ever. The way they weave the story of Vince stacking the deck against Rock, with matches against the guys from the corporation, while making you think that Mankind was Vince's choice, was fantastic. The culmination of Austin being brought back by Shane only to screw with him again. Perfect example of intertwining storylines. Only negative was reliving the Montreal screw job from the year before. Damian Ray from TPWW says The Rock winning his first world title was always a big mark once he got going in the Nation, and even though it was a heel turn, I still popped for him as it meant he was now the man regardless of his allegiance. Also, kickstarted what would be the WWF's ultimate comeback against WCW in the ratings war, as Foley's win a few months later would swing the momentum in their favour while simultaneously building the second biggest star in the company. Otto Demvons from the UK Fan Forum says from the very first video package, reclaiming each man will do whatever it takes to be the man, through the subplots that have Austin being foiled by the McMahons, Undertaker and Kane's blood feud, and Foley being manipulated by Vince, the story arc is beautifully constructed. As so rarely is the case in wrestling, this event feels like a well-crafted film. It uses the time it has effectively. The story is layered and involves interesting characters who the audience feels strongly about. The match quality isn't great, but it hardly matters as you're so engrossed with the way the destiny of the title seems to twist and turn throughout the night. The announcers, wrestlers, and other on-screen personalities make the title feel like the most important thing in the world. It's such an easy thing to do, but it adds so much to the whole scenario. By the end, you feel genuinely gutted for Foley and pure disgust towards Rock, which is incredible considering how much the fans are in Rock's corner all the way until the very end of the show. JR's They Screwed Us All call hammers it all home. The whole thing is a riveting ride, even despite the worst chair shot in history from Gerald Briscoe. It's a top 5 pay-per-view of all time, my own personal favourite Survivor Series. This is the best example of an authority heel faction angle they've ever done. It spawned a white-hot babyface and a red-hot heel, and ensured reactions for another white-hot babyface for months and months to come. This was the complete dissolution of the Survivor Series format. I mean, we got nothing of the kind. It's elimination, which I guess is the closest thing you can say here, but completely different. Obviously, the belts vacant go into this show, a huge tournament to decide who's going to be the new champion, and a lot of people feel this is Vince Russo's finest hour in the WWF. The Rock leaves as a heel, and again, Kieran, I just remember asking you who won the tournament when you came home. After you read on the internet at school, I said, who won the belt? And you say, Rocky won it. And I was like, yay! And then you say, but he's with Vince. It's like, oh.
Yeah, that was it. We were so happy our man had made it. It's so disappointing. Why did he have to do it with Rocky? Just wanted him as a babyface.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a good overall story. The matches aren't. There's nothing to most of it, really.
No.
But then there is so many of them. You know, you've got a first round before the quarters, and a women's match, and a tag match. Resistant to give Russo too much credit. I think you can see his fingerprints there.
Oh, for sure.
But, like, if he had left to his own device to book this, it would have been a complete clusterfuck with nothing making sense.
Oh, Oklahoma would have made the semis.
I was going to say, we all saw what he would do a year later in WCW with the tournament that ended at Mayhem.
Yeah. Deadly game, that was not.
I think the goal of the show is obviously that definitely puts it up there in terms of the best. And I think in terms of, like, a massive tournament, this is better than, say, WrestleMania 4. But saying that, I still think we easily could have gone about those first round matches. Shrink it down a little bit, really, because I remember just kind of watching this for the first time, hour of the pay-per-view or something, being a bit kind of eye-rolling, really, because a lot of the results are quite obvious. Besides the X-Pac and a man's man going to a double count.
Yeah, really weird finish to that match, by the way.
Yeah, the show really doesn't really kind of, like, kick in until, like, the semis. I mean, there's some fun stuff here and there, but it's the Mankind beating Austin and then Rock beating Undertaker, and just kind of seeing this interesting dynamic at the time of Rock facing Mankind. Yeah, I mean, because he was only briefly a babyface at this point, wasn't he?
Two months.
And it's just like, just mentioned that this was, like, the greatest corporation or authoritative kind of, like, faction group. I think he's absolutely right, because I think, like, Rock was the missing piece, I think, in the Austin McMahon feud. Throughout most of this year, you know, McMahon's trying to throw people in Austin's ray. You know, he used Dude Love, which was, and I love Mick very much as the next person, but he didn't look like a corporate champion. He tries using Undertaker and Kane at different points, and it's just like, none of it's kind of like viable yet, that this is someone, these are the guys that Vince would actually get behind. And then in comes Rock, chiseled out of stone, and it's just like, yeah.
No, didn't he had his bitch tits?
Yeah. Okay. Well, he for another couple months he did. Yeah, he's literally like, it's like, there you go. That's what Vince McMahon would think should be the champion right now. This kind of, like, that writer was absolutely right in saying that the Rock joining the corporation is
the best authoritative group of all time.
The comparison that somebody made is it's the pay-per-view that reads like a movie, because it's actually something that's got a thread from start to finish. There's twists and turns throughout. It is a really good show as a standalone. Again, not necessarily for the wrestling, but just for the idea. And it's a shame that I didn't get to see this live when it happened, not knowing the Destiny thing. I knew the outcome, like I said, because I asked you, Kieran, what it was. If I saw a show like this and didn't know where the belt was ending up, I can see this show having a great impact, because that thing of Rock turning heel was like just a kick in the balls to me. And of course, Foley comes out with some sympathy at the end as well. Austin gets fucked over. The only thing that I didn't like, and I think that the Russo fingerprints are, I never liked the idea of Vince fires Austin, Shane hires him back, Shane's really a heel all along. Like, what the fuck's the point?
Yeah, there's
one, two, gives him the finger.
Yeah, there's a hole in the logic there, but it is all about the story and the tangled web that's weaved throughout the show, which obviously culminates in the Rock winning the tournament. I must admit, I didn't really have any problem with them revisiting Montreal for the purposes of this. You know, it's not something that they, you know, that particular finish they hadn't really hammed up too much at this point. So I didn't have a problem with them doing that in terms of tying Rock into the corporation, getting sympathy on Foley, and obviously Austin getting screwed prior to that. So you've got two baby faces with an axe to grind now. Much like yourself, Kieran, I am reluctant to give Russo too much credit for anything, really. But I suppose in truth, his fingerprints are involved on this song. And I suppose even the sun shines out of a dog's arse on a good day. So I'll give...
Even a blind mouse finds a occasional piece of cheese.
Mm-hmm. A broken clock is right twice a day.
We'll move on now to a Survivor Series that didn't get nearly the same acclaim that the last one did. 1999, the last one on the docket for this week. The only person who wanted to write anything about this show was Drax Spago from the UK Fan Forum, who simply said, "Looking back, it's more interesting than a great moment or event, but it's the crowd at this show at Survivor Series 99. The show took place in the middle of their greatest era, and yet to watch that show in isolation, you think absolutely no one was over. The match with Too Cool in springs to mind as being wrestled in front of a completely silent crowd. Mental to think all anyone had to do throughout the first half of 2000 was walk down the ramp and they go mental regardless of who it was. No one else had anything kind to say about the show in the slightest, and I'm not going to join in on that either. I think this show is... I fucking hate it. This, to me, is the remnants of the negative things Russo had brought along, and in fact, just the roster in general. The lack of depth in 99 and a generally poor year, even though the company was on fire. There was a lot of dreck in 99. It wasn't the best product. When you look at the Survivor Series matches on this show, which they brought back, just look at some of it. Val Venus, Mark Henry, Gangrel and Blackman against the Posse and Davey Boy. As Danny Glover once said, someone get that shit off my lawn. That's just terrible.
I don't quite remember that the crowd was that bad.
No, they were.
I don't remember the crowd being that bad, sorry, for the Two Cool Hollies versus Hardys and Edge and Christian.
They were.
They were.
I mean, I share Liam's thoughts on this show entirely. We've talked before when it comes to 99 and how, whilst the product was hot and we generally at the time were all enjoying it as we were watching it, when you look back at it now and hold it under closer scrutiny, a lot of things don't hold up from that year, and this is a prime example of it. The card is not much to look at. Obviously, you've got the complete bait and switch from Vince.
Oh, yeah, Austin.
Who knew days in advance that Austin wasn't going to be able to wrestle on the show, and then they do the hit-and-run angle to get him out of the main event, only to replace him with the Big Show.
Who wins the belt.
Who then wins the belt, having been involved in a upper-mid card, at best, you could maybe call it, if you want to put rose-tinted specs on, feud with the Boss Man. Because let's face it, you mentioned terrible teams there. Let's look at the Big Boss Man's team of Albert, Midian and Viscera.
It is unfortunate. Do you remember who Big Show's partners were supposed to be in this match that you beat up beforehand?
One of them was the Blue Meanie. I can't remember the other two.
It was Kai and Tai.
Well, there you go.
That would have given Colonel Mustafa a run for his money on the shit
team. Just speaks to like you said, the depth of the... at the time. But
Tori, Deborah, Moolah and May against Luna, Terry, Ivory and Jacqueline, which ends in a double clothesline from the old broads on Ivory and Jim Ross right before it gets the pin. They do the double clothesline and Char goes, "Well, that would look better on fast forward." And then that's the finish.
All the while Jerry Lawler's making jokes because the pinfall in the match is sudden death.
Yeah, you don't want to say sudden death on Moolah and May.
But try and find some shine light. At least Kurt Angle debuted.
against meat.
Yeah, against
Planet Stasiak.
Crowd's not exactly hot for that either. China pinning Chris Jericho was absolutely criminal.
That's just
on
a
this
complete
show.
Travesty off the worst pedigree you'll ever
you
see.
You can't call that a pedigree. It was dire.
It's absolutely it's the forearms. It's farcical. It's just a joke.
The forearms that China was throwing in this match need to be seen to be believed.
Yeah, it's just it's a really terrible card. not without a noteworthy event. Obviously, it's Steve Austin on the show for the better part of a year, which you know, in itself is of course news. But you know, this as a show is just god awful. And the reason the crowd are so dead, in particular from that point on, is because I think. I could be wrong with my chronology here, but it's at that point in the show where they announce that Austin isn't going to be in the main event.
Yeah, yeah. The crowd deflates immediately.
The crowd just dies. They were already quiet because of what had happened, and you sort of, you know, you imagine you're a fan in the audience at that point. You're thinking, oh, Austin's put on a stretcher and been wheeled out. Where does that leave the main event? So they're in two minds.
Yeah, they probably know deep down they're not getting what they want, but they're holding on to hope.
And then they get the announcement, and it just kills the crowd completely.
It's fun watching that China-Jericho match, not because the match is good, because China's awful, but just to see the reactions from the crowd, where when China's on offense, the crowd's completely dead, with the exception of about 15 women who are screaming furiously at everything that China does. And then as soon as Jericho kicks out or something, or if he gets a little bit of offense, the crowd goes, fuck, the guys go crazy. They can't stand it either.
And that's only magnified a month later when Chris Jericho is an out-and-out heel. Let's not forget at this point, tied China to a chair and hit a hand with a hammer, I believe, in storyline. By the time we roll round to Armageddon, the crowd pops completely when he puts her in the Walls of Jericho and drags her back to the middle of the ring as she's getting near the ropes.
The Survivor Series matches on this show have absolutely no bearing on anything. It's just filler. Yeah. I barely know her. Big Show winning the belt doesn't last long. It's a make good to the live audience, allegedly, for fucking him over with Austin. This show's bad. This I don't think you want to say the worst Survivor Series we've talked about today, but this is close. If it's not the worst, if it's not this or 94, I'll be surprised.
94, I think, but this is close.
Put it this way.
At least 95 had Bret and Bach, which was a decent match until the winner.
Yeah, I mean, we can possibly disagree on a position here or there, perhaps for where you would rank the show, but none of us are arguing the toss that it should be down there.
Yeah.
It's that comment of just like the crowd being dead during the Too Cool and Hollies, Hardys and Edge and Christian. I'm not denying that it was dead. I'm just surprised that it was dead, particularly considering this is like 1 month after the ladder match.
It's a bit of revisions in that match. That match happened and they were megastars. That's not really the way it went, to be quite honest. Edge and Christian were cold as ice till they won the tag team championships, as far as I'm concerned. The Hardys got there a little bit earlier than Edge and Christian did in terms of getting really over with the crowd. But by this point, they're over, but they're not over enough to sustain. Steve Austin's been taken off the show, and you're not getting what you paid for.
Yeah, I mean, they're you know, when it comes to that, the No Mercy match itself and the ladder match, they're not popping because of the individuals involved at that point. They're popping for the sort of the car wreck they're seeing.
So that pretty much sums up what we've had so far. In closing, got a couple bits of feedback I want to get to here. T. Lynch 106 from F4W says, I've probably seen every Survivor Series elimination tag match from 90 to 97 in excess of 10 times each. The 90 show was always one of my favourites when you had all of the heel winners face all of the face winners in the main event, to Santana made onto the team with Hogan and Warrior. I also love that the show would take place in and around Thanksgiving, and have fond memories of Afro the Wild Samoan coming to the ring with a turkey. One of my other favourites was 93 when Marty Jannetty and the 1-2-3 Kid survived. Such an underrated match. 96, I remember they never really announced much about Rocky Maivia, Flash Funk and Furnace and LaFon making their debuts, but if you had the WWF magazine, their names were on the and this made that show a lot more fun. When I got older, Jack Sabbath ran a video store across the road from my house, a lot of video store references on the show today, and introduced me to the earlier Survivor Series shows as he ran a wrestling blockbuster where you can rent the tapes. I rented the first three shows and instantly became a huge fan of the 10 tag team matches and the unique pairings you would see throughout the night. I really wish they'd do the shows full of only the traditional tag matches again. Really looking forward to this podcast. M. Price from Pro Wrestling Only says, I am much the same both as a lot of people that have responded. I love the first few shows. Wow, just looking at them tells you how much of an influence Survivor Series was for the first few years. It's a shame how much it has dropped off over the last 10 years or so. The 87 and 88 shows were probably some of my favourite shows to watch because of the depth of the rosters at the time. Looking back now, you had tons of WWF champions, WCW champions, tag team champs, and future legends. It is just crazy to see what the roster became when compared to now. And wrapping it up, the the Cynic from TPWW says, and contrary to T. Lynch's point, I used to just like the random teams. It's not like today where you get a lot of 6-man and 8-man tags. Back then it was just cool to see so many named guys in one match. But then the matches themselves were pretty lame for the most part. It's always been a weird event to me. So in wrapping up this part of our Survivor Series retrospective, just thoughts around the table in closing about the period we talked about today, 87 to 99, in its struggle for identity and relevance. We saw them chop and change a lot of what the show was supposed to be. Originally a unique, distinctive show, as you mentioned, Carl, changed as the nature of the business changed, and they needed big matches to draw. They went to the title matches in 91. They killed the concept completely in 92. They kind of played with it for a few years. 98, they blew it up again and did a tournament. And by 99, it's in an awkward position, mix and match.
Yeah, I think maybe, as I said before, the nature of it comes from its inception of being kind of just a fuck you show to Crockett. It was a concept that in its early days was a novelty to see so many guys in the same place at the same time, you know, weaned on a squash match laden TV format. But I think even, as you say, from the fourth show on, they were stretching for ideas, and I think that's kind of its legacy is borne out over time. Obviously in recent years they've been thinking about dropping it as a pay-per-view completely.
Yeah.
As you know, so I think even from the early years that was there, and then obviously as the TV landscape changed and we're getting multi-man tag matches on a frequent basis, it's just compounded that spiral of relevance for the pay-per-view, really.
It's a show that by the time you're in the fourth or fifth year, it's really struggling for its identity, or at least they're trying to pull away from the tag concept in many respects. By 91, as we said, the selling point's a title match. 92, they give up on it. Revisit it in 93, 94, but again, there's still a world title match in 94. 95, again, the selling point is the world title match. 96, it's Bret Austin. 97, Bret Shawn. And in many respects, when you're getting into that period then, and we've talked about it throughout the show, you're seeing that the tag matches themselves, rather than, say, go from the early years, you've got the likes of Andre. Just to use the first show as an example, you're going from Savage, Steamboat, Roberts in one match, Andre, Hogan in another. By the time you get to 97, it's the Truth Commission against the DOA. Just to show you how insignificant the tag matches then become. 98, it's the title and a tournament. 99, you know, we've talked about who was going to be on the Big Show's team. And the fact that, again, the selling point for the show was a triple threat match. Very early on, they tried, maybe not deliberately, but in a sense they've pulled away from the tag concept. And by the time we've got to 99... it's still there, but it's very much just, it's there because it's Survivor Series, as opposed to, we want to make this a real significant element of anything.
It becomes obvious that Survivor Series stops becoming a show of its own identity, as in they were thinking like, right, we got Survivor Series coming up, we need to move all the chess pieces around to fit Survivor Series so it makes sense. That's not what they're doing. Instead of turning around and saying, let's manoeuvre Survivor Series round so it fits into what particular storylines we're doing at the moment, which to me doesn't come across as a major show. Major shows like Royal Rumble, WrestleMania, SummerSlam, the company's built around heading towards those shows. Survivor Series is just turned, by the time we get to like 92, isn't it? By the time we get to 92, they're just turning around and saying, like, what? How can Survivor Series help us now? Really, with the exception of a few matches on those earlier shows, really the only kind of standout shows for me personally is 96 and 98, due to just obviously 96, the two main matches that we've already talked about, and the 98 tournament, which is probably one of the better pay-per-view filled tournaments that they've ever done, because it actually has an agenda.
I think part of the struggle for Survivor Series, and we've kind of talked about it quite a bit, the nature of what it was with the tag matches doesn't lend itself to being a blow-off show. And therefore, you've got, Royal Rumble is the start of something naturally. WrestleMania is the culmination of something naturally. So is SummerSlam. Survivor Series in its tag team format doesn't really afford you the same luxury. In some regards, I mean, the closest you can come is maybe 90 with Hogan and Earthquake. That's pretty much the end of that. You can see that they were kind of reverting very early on to changing the way the pay-per-view was structured so they could get something else in there that could maybe serve as a blow-off to obviously sell to the public. Beyond the novelty of tag matches, there really wasn't all that much. I've got more of a nostalgia, I think, than you, G, when it comes to the first, you know, four or five, in terms of the Survivor Series matches, because to me, they didn't have to be cracking matches, necessarily. It was the novelty of seeing how it all kind of played out. And you did get your great match, like the tag team match, the super tag team matches you mentioned, the one with Brett making the big comeback, and there's a handful of others, and there will be a handful of others in the next podcast. We'll get to two great Survivor Series matches in part two. Yeah, you know, yeah.
Tying to what you say, it's a tying together show. You just, okay, we just overlap some feuds and have guys. It's hard to build, there's no real purpose behind the matches rather than doing a few crossover, but it's what you get on a weekly basis for the last 20 years, whatever, anyway. It's, you know, inherent problems, I guess.
Next week, we'll, of course, be talking about the year 2000, the year 2014 for Survivor Series, and again, continuing the evaluation of the identity and the relevance of this show. I've personally enjoyed it. I hope you listening at home have as well. You can, of course, listen to our archives at squaredcirclegazette.com or like us on Facebook. In the meantime, we will be back next week with part two of our Survivor Series retrospective. So, thank you very much for listening. For G. John Chase.
Hey, we got Brock next time.
For Carl Jones.
I'm thankful for my belligerence, xenophobia, and alcoholism.
And for Kieran O'Rourke.
Brett screwed Brett.
I am Liam O'Rourke, and we are out of here.
Yo, Hulkamaniacs! I can tell you what the Hulkster's mostly happy about. It's Survivor Series time, and I'm thankful for my team of Hulkamaniacs. I'm thankful because I'm rich, and you're not.
I'm thankful for having Damien and the DDT.
You know what we're thankful for?
We don't have to fight each other!
Oh, yeah. I am thankful that I am the only man worthy of being the Macho King.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I'm thankful for the privilege of living right here in the good old U.S. of A.
Tough guy.
I'm thankful I've got that big earthquake on my side.
What I'm thankful for Thanksgiving, for my polka dots.
I'm thankful for the judges I serve.
I'm thankful for wrestling, cutting, and strutting.
I'm thankful for my good looks.
I'm thankful for having the most ravishing body in the WWF.
I'm thankful because I ate Ricky Rude.
I am thankful for being the world's smartest man.
I'm thankful for being absolutely perfect.
Yeah, we're thankful for having sardine stuffing in our turkey tonight!
I'm thankful for spending Thanksgiving with all the members of the Heenan family.
Thanksgiving every day, but especially this day, as the Warriors give me the intention to deliver the pair at Survivor Series, it is going to be a war!